Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's The Wonky Show. We're live at our Secret Life of Students event in London today, where we talk shocking student stats on loneliness. We'll ask what can be done. There's Campus Culture Wars chat, and is the way HE is portrayed on TV balanced? It's all coming up.
And that's something that we're really kind of deliberately looking at, is how do you scaffold those in, and then how do you bring those out throughout the year to provide that those connections and set people off to a good start.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, here live with lunchtime diehards at the Shaw Theatre in London, where we're spending the day understanding the contemporary student experience and working out what to do about it. Here to help us get a grip on what's been going on, as usual, three fantastic guests. Rebecca Freeman is Deputy Pro Vice-Chancellor Education at University of Warwick. Becky, your highlight of the morning, please.
So there's been a lot, but I think for me, the biggest one this morning has been hearing from the students, some of the student stories that we've heard about their own experiences on campus of loneliness, confidence, and how they've navigated that. And there was just an amazing quote from one of our students, Natalia, who talked about, who said, "I think of university as providing students with the ingredients, and it's up to students to make the cake," and really thinking about that concept. How do we provide those ingredients and get those to students?
And of course, later we were actually talking literally about cooking and the idea of providing ingredients. So who knows? Maybe we can take it literally and kind of metaphorically, I guess. David Gilani is Head of Student Engagement and Advocacy at Middlesex University. David, your highlight of the morning.
For me, I'm not saying this just because it was your session, Jim, but it was the data you presented around how central student sense of belonging is to a myriad of other factors, which we're trying to work on to enhance the student experience. As you know, it's an area I'm really fascinated with, and it's wonderful to see it being advocated for at an event like this.
Great stuff. And Mark Leach is Editor-in-Chief at Wonky. Mark, your highlight of the morning.
Hi, Jim. Well, apart from being back here at Secret Life for Students for the seventh time, we think, it's probably being on the podcast as a guest, which is always a very novel thing for me. So instead of hosting it, so that's fun.
So yes, we start this week with loneliness. We published new data and analysis from both our GTI Sybil Belong platform and from the UPP Foundation Student Futures Commission. And there's lots to take in, Mark.
Yes, that's right. So we've got lots of fresh data about what students think. We've done some polling ourselves from Belong, which is our student insights platform we run with Sybil. There's the UPP Foundation Student Futures work. And we've been really interrogating why loneliness has become such a corrosive phenomenon, how it impacts on all aspects of student lives and their outcomes, unfortunately. And something we've covered a lot on the site over the last several years. Unfortunately, most of the indicators that we've been polling about are getting worse. But drilling beneath some of the detail, we learn about the importance of friendship groups and community, which sounds kind of obvious when you think about it, but the impact that has on what students say about their course is really, really startling. So when they've got friends on their course, they're much more likely to say staff are supporting their learning well. And there's similar numbers on student support staff as well. Where they've got friends, their perceptions of their whole interaction with their university experience is completely altered, and that's really fascinating. It's related to their health, satisfaction, and outcomes. We've also got a new piece of work with Solution Path about how, in the context of all of this, we put together a new way of thinking about academic support. Obviously, it's no mean feat, given everything we're talking about today, and the limitations on personal tutoring systems. They can tend to rely on students coming forward spontaneously and have run the risk always of putting too much work and workload onto academics. So trying to reimagine those in the context of this loneliness crisis is very, very important piece of work that we're working on at the moment. And as ever, we're just reminded by the data and its analysis why loneliness really is just such a wicked and complex problem to try and tackle, but tackle it we must.
Yes. Becky, I guess I was about to say I've got two parts of my brain. That's a stupid thing to say, but I'm often in two minds about this, right? So on one level, it's kind of obvious, I guess, that if students aren't feeling connected, they're going to place more demands on academic staff or student support staff and so on. And so if I haven't got any friends and that support, their judgment of that support might be more harsh. On the other side of my brain, though, it is the case, isn't it, that quite often either in the sector nationally or inside universities, we might be discussing services over here and then, kind of students and their social capital in another space. And bringing those together is tough, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if some of the questions that we're asking about this are really about how do things connect and how do students access things and see things. So for me, and I can remember talking to some students just before the pandemic about what would, actually it was a design thinking event, so what would good student support look like? And what they talked about was a kind of network of brilliant services, a great personal tutor, peer support, and then I think also there's loads of other stuff like learner analytics or things that that look at what engagement is there that might enable us to be proactive in this space. So I think some of those statistics that you presented this morning, to me, really reinforce that sense that actually if you feel more connected generally, you feel more connected, you're more able to make the most of those services, but make the most of your personal tutor, but also perhaps feel more confident in asking questions. You've got a peer support network where you can do that informally, you can check things, you can mutter as you leave the room, did you understand that bit after about 40 minutes, how can we work this out? And so then really working out when to ask the questions, building the confidence and that kind of peer support to do that just makes everything more accessible. So I think there's perhaps something in that in those statistics
kind of
too.
Tying it together.
Yeah.
David, I mean, one of the things we were looking at this morning was that, what students say would make a difference on this question, right? Mm. And some of it was the sort of thing you would expect, joining clubs and societies, blah, blah, blah. But I guess the two that, I'm not sure they're shocking, but they do present challenges are, I want to spend more time on campus and I want to hang out more with students, effectively were the two answers. But those are really hard in a cost of living and cost of, engagement time. This is tough stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's so much of this which the challenge of how much of these challenges are things outside the control of universities that we're just asking for problems if we even try to pretend like we can solve them, and in doing so take the responsibility away from the real actors that should be making a difference. You could argue that actually covers up the problem and makes it worse in the longer term. But at the same time, you can't just have that feedback from students and not want to try and do something about it. We're all here, spending our days at a conference like this because there's something in us which gets excited about being able to support our students in ways that perhaps are better than we have in the past. But yeah, absolutely. So that the two you brought up there, spending more time on campus, it's really clear that we know that as time goes on, if you look at students, when they talk about belonging in a longitudinal approach, you can see that there is this virtuous cycle between engagement and belonging. Once you engage a little bit, it makes it, you build up your connections, you build up your networks, it helps you feel that sense of belonging. And that sense of belonging then gives you the confidence to keep turning up, to ask those questions, to seek the available support. And that can be really, really positive. Of course, it can go the exact opposite way. And I guess that was coming through in some of the research this morning as well. It's the students who stop turning up, who then feel bad about asking their lecturer a question because they think, if I ask that question, what if that was covered in the session I didn't attend? So I stop asking questions. And obviously, if you stop asking questions, you fall even further behind. And that can just become spiraling out of control. I really like, Becca, what you mentioned there around how students might not talk about learner analytics systems, but actually that can be a really useful way for us to be able to look at engagement data that students are showing us and almost identify students who perhaps we can intervene with earlier where they may be on a downward trajectory in terms of their sense of belonging at university. And if you can spot it from an engagement perspective, you could perhaps do something for that student to get them back on track, normalize the fact that every student is going to have periods of time where they're not going to be able to engage as easily, and hopefully normalize it to some extent and then work out what you can do to get them back in that positive direction. But that's, going back to the first thing I said, that's not going to be able to overcome those systemic issues. If for some students, if you say to everyone, those who spend more time on campus have higher grades, that is not going to be fair for every student who has everything else going on in their lives.
And that's interesting, Mark, isn't it? Because, partly I think in the kind of tenor of response from government and to some extent opposition it does feel like we are settling into a new normal which accepts that students will have significantly less money than they've had in the past, or at least some of them. And as a result, we need to settle into a new normal where they're visiting campus less often than they used to. But that presents a puzzle when, you know, the data is telling us they want to spend more time with each other and want to spend more time on campus. Now, is this complicated? Do we need lots of kind of data and systems, or is this as simple as, you know, we just need more places to sit, man?
Yeah, I go back and forth about that. And the point at which, you know, university's responsibility ends and starts is not always clear. We talked a lot about this morning about health, which was a really interesting aspect of this conversation, because, you know, one of the major problems there is the way that students are othered, that no one takes responsibility for them. If you go to DfE and you talk about student mental health, they say, oh, what are you doing? There's nothing to do with us. Go to Department for Health. You go to the Department of Health and they say, why on earth are you here? Go to DfE. And it's a kind of circular argument. No one outside of universities are taking care of that. So the sector has to do a kind of sweeping up, which is unfortunate because universities are not designed to be, you know, primary healthcare providers and all the rest. The point at which kind of the responsibility ends is really, really hard to get a grip on, and particularly where there's you know, fewer resources. Students would rather their money was spent on their education that they're paying for. You know, this comes up time and time again. The amount that universities can do is so small compared to the scale of the challenge.
Yeah.
We talked about the mental health, not just amongst students, but, you know, in the population, all sorts of other trends as well that need kind of cross sector and cross party and certainly government more joined up policy making and thinking. You know, it feels like sometimes we're tilting at windmills. So I don't know. I go back and forth about that one, Jim.
Yeah, Becky, I get a sense that kind of in the sort of romance of higher education, that, you know, it's kind of history and, you know, all the narratives that surround it, we might have taken students kind of getting to know each other and interacting with each other for granted, partly because they were there all the time, partly because they were all the same, you know, partly because they had plenty of resources and didn't have other draws on their time. But I do get a sense, you know, even now when I talk to people, you know, at all levels in universities, oh my God, what, now we have to help them make friends? Like, is that really a role for universities?
I don't know if I hear from students that they want us to help them make friends. I think they feel like they're good at that, but I think it's providing those opportunities and thinking about, and for me, that entry point is academic departments. So we know that students have signed up to do their course, and so you've got something there, you've got a collective interest, although recognising that people make friends outside of their course as well, or feel those connections more strongly sometimes. Yeah. But I think within that space, you've got a real opportunity to scaffold and structure some of that connection building. So whether it's about the induction week, how much are we in academic departments and what kinds of activities are we doing there? Yeah. Certainly when I was in an academic department, I still am sometimes, we used to do a lot about how do you build rapport? So rapport with each other, but rapport with your personal tutor. And actually some of that was really addressing some of that staff confidence about having those conversations. How do you build rapport with an 18-year-old, if that's what you've got in front of you, without that being awkward or asking what A-levels they did, which is not a recipe for a good chat. So actually doing activities, doing kind of team activities that were low stakes, that were not about how much have you achieved, but about, oh, who are we? How do we kind of get to know each other? How do we provide that space? I think there's a real opportunity there in courses, and that's something that we're really kind of deliberately looking at, is how do you scaffold those in, and then how do you bring those out throughout the year to provide those connections and set people off to a good start.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, David, I was in Stockholm at the weekend for the Swedish pre-selection for the Eurovision.
And of course you were.
I am going down an escalator at one point, and coming up an escalator were four students all dressed in pink overalls, right? So I again get to the bottom of the escalator, chase them up the escalator, hope they don't report me to the police for being weird, and try and work out who they are. And it turned out they were all from the same academic department. They were all from computer science. And they've been planning an event that morning. And I'm expecting them to say they were planning a giant summer ball or something kind of massive. And they're saying, no, we're planning a quiz for the weekend. And there's something, I think, potentially quite kind of quaint about lots of what needs to be done, isn't there? It's partly about the way a module starts or the kind of activities that happen during a welcome week or whatever. Some of this feels actually really within our grasp.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge with sense of belonging is that it's potentially 100 different things that you need to do to make it work for students, and especially the fact that every student will have different needs when it comes to what make them feel that sense of belonging at university. But the benefit is that it's often not about doing anything extra. It's not about 100 extra things. It's just about the lens we use to look at the stuff we're already doing. It is exactly that. So, you know, it is the way in which the modules are designed so that you do have those low stakes early form of group work where, you know, students aren't going to get into an argument because if they don't get on with their people in their group,
they're going to fail.
No. The whole point of it is to learn exactly that, how to start having those discussions where you're working with others at university. It's not about having a whole new approach to your welcome induction activities, but it's just around bringing some students in as part of those welcome talks. So they talk about their experiences at university. One of the things that I love that we've been able to bring in from kind of the Middlesex context are these what we wish we'd known sessions, where students essentially normalise the challenges of meeting friends at university, how there are points where you go through the dip. A lot of those things which can be really scary if people think when they're going through their first year at university and they get to this first point of challenge and they think, that's a sign that I'm the one failing. Whereas if another student in their second year has already told them they went through that same thing, when they get to that dip, they don't have that feeling of, it's a sign that I'm not meant to be here. It's a sign, everyone goes through this at some point, and most students get past that if they utilise the support that's available to them. So in a way, I think that the challenge is how we can look at all of these different things which crop up and the way in which students talk about all of these different things which might help them to belong, not as a extra amount of resource that needs to go in, but just a way of slightly reframing what we're already doing in these areas. That's the constant balance, I think, is really important, because we also know that there's this really close connection between staff belonging and well-being and student belonging and well-being.
Yep.
And obviously what we don't want is to burn out all of the people who are working in front of students so they never have any time or energy to just be compassionate in front of the person who's there in front of them. That's the situation where nobody is going to feel like they belong. And you know that's the challenge, is there is more of these topics which get put on pressure for staff to deliver for students. They're caught up in all of the huge things they might need to prepare and deliver, and forget that a lot of it is just a student knowing that there is someone who they can go to and have a conversation with when they've got a problem. And for a staff member to develop that type of relationship, they need time and energy to be able to be approachable. Being approachable can't be done if you're trying to do it on top of 101 other different things.
Mark, just before we come off this, there's in some of the data that I was looking at last week, there's a really big intersection with disability, right? And, you know, both with mental health conditions and specific learning conditions. Anxiety is a kind of big intersecting feature, and anxiety around getting involved and hanging out with other students and so on is in the mix. And it strikes me that we have a kind of set of assumptions and a system in the UK that supports disabled students with the academic bit, but absolutely doesn't necessarily put in the support and the funding and everything else for disabled students with the rest of their life. And that we do probably need to look at that again, don't we, as a society, as a sector, and so on.
We need to look at this. This is a much bigger question than what happens inside universities. We've got a mental health crisis across the whole of society. We're getting sicker, and at a time when our healthcare system is under enormous pressure, without a lot of light at the end of a tunnel. So, in the context of stress in the wider public finances, not just on universities. So, yes, this is a cross-cutting issue, a wicked problem, but we've got some great expertise inside universities, and hopefully that's going to be brought to bear.
Great stuff. Lots more on the site about that. Do take a look. Good. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Nicola Watchman-Smith, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the challenges and the practical action we can take in the student belonging space. In the blog, I've suggested a shift in the notion of value added and educational gain, proposing that the activities and interventions outside of the classroom are as integral to those inside of that teaching space. Alongside this, I've shamelessly publicised our new Student Belonging Good Practice Guide, written with my colleagues Claire Garden and Connor Norton, and in association with the wonderful RAISE Network. The guide is jam-packed with hints, tips, case studies and student opinion that we hope will really help universities and colleges that are looking to do student belonging in a practical and enhanced way. Happy reading.
This morning, Kirsty Sedgman, the author of On Being Unreasonable, Smita Jamdar, partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau, and Andy Winter, director of student support services at the University of Sheffield, gathered on stage here at SLOS with our editor, Debbie McVitty, to explore the issues, where Debbie started by asking Smita to explore both ends of the campus culture wars seesaw.
The reason that I find this a really fascinating topic is we are trying to balance a number of competing priorities, some of which are driven by the kind of statistics you've talked about, and some of which are driven by people external to the university making policy decisions. And where I feel we've ended up is a set of entirely contradictory legal principles, to the point where there is now an argument, in my view, that we're failing basic rule of law tests, like can you predict in advance what the consequence of a particular decision you might make? So let's just explore some of those tensions. So the first is, as Debbie said, you've got a raft of legislation now that deals with freedom of expression, freedom of speech, the right to say things. That stems from the European Convention. We've got domestic legislation, which has obviously changed and is changing as the new Act comes fully into force. But on the other side, you've got a lot of legislation which is about freedom from harm. And it's freedom from harm for the individual. So there are criminal offences at stake here. There's obviously the concept of unlawful harassment contrary to the Equality Act. But there's freedom of harm for society as well. So we've got prevent, the idea that we must stop certain extremist views circulating. We've got legislation around lack of, you know, not encouraging terrorism, not supporting proscribed organisations. So these are legal requirements that are pulling in opposite directions. We've also got this tension about the fact that freedom of speech, the legislation, frames it as being free speech within the law. You must do what's reasonably practicable to uphold that within universities. On the other side, you've got this idea of, can somebody reasonably feel harassed by what's being said by someone else? And that is a reason to interfere with freedom of speech. But of course, the concept of reasonableness is quite different to the concept of being within or outside the law. That is a binary thing. Something's within the law, something's outside it. Reasonableness, and I use this phrase all the time, is that reasonable people can reasonably disagree about what the option should be in a particular circumstance. That's what reasonableness means. It means no right or wrong answers. So we're constantly faced with having to make different judgments. And my fear is that the OFS, for example, sticks too closely to this idea of within the law, outside the law. But that is not a test we can reasonably apply within a university. The second, the other areas that I think where there are conflicts is a lot of this is about individual acts, people talking, people saying things, but there's a collective impact on the community, how people react to it, what else people might say alongside that, which compounds the effect on certain groups. But how do we interfere with individual rights because it's upsetting to the community without breaching those very individual concepts of freedom of speech? The decisions you have to make in the moment when you're faced with people who are on opposite sides of a particular situation, you've got some people very unhappy, some people very angry, are not very easy to make into processes. They are judgments. So you can have a process that says people have got to go through, you know, certain complaints processes, but someone at the end of the day has to make a judgment in the here and now. Obviously, when you get to court, there's a huge benefit of hindsight issue. Everybody could see how it played out, and that's how you're then judged about whether you upheld free speech or not. And I think that means universities can feel a bit paralysed about how they actually go through this process and make confident judgments to support people's freedom of speech or to prevent harm. I think we have got two further issues I'd just flag up here. One is, you alluded to it, Debbie, that your polling suggests that there is this real benefit to people feeling they belong, this concept of feeling safe in the environment that you're in, and that is something that's really important to people being confident in expressing their speech. But the law doesn't really recognise that as a thing that needs protecting. So for the law, psychological safety is quite narrowly defined. It doesn't extend to that broad sense of, you know, feeling safe. It's about psychological harm, or it's about feeling harassed, etc. So that concept of the benefit of psychological safety in facilitating free speech is almost missing from the law, and that makes it quite difficult for universities to know how to respond to it. And finally, and a big issue, is, again, we hear all the time that students are more likely to speak, anyone is more likely to speak, if they feel that the institution within which they operate shares their values. They can go in there, they can express themselves, they're comfortable about it. But within the free speech model, what the call is for institutional neutrality. You say nothing because that will actually facilitate other people being able to fill the space, staff and students. But that really does then mean a lot of people do not feel comfortable speaking. They feel they're operating in a kind of corporate void. They don't know whether the place they've joined is supportive to them. So I could go on forever because I've got a long, long list of the problems that the law faces when it's trying to deal with this area. But I think the takeaway that I would say to this is that people are going to have to make judgments. People are going to get it wrong. People are going to end up in court and people are going to lose. But that's okay. That isn't should not be seen as the end of the world, because ultimately these are really, really difficult situations involving multiple competing rights. If we could do anything, we should be slightly more forgiving to each other and to the environment that universities find themselves in, to say it's tough, but we can keep working towards the kind of culture we want to create. But things will go wrong in the meantime and we just have to be a bit kind about that. That would be my thought.
I think that conclusion that actually we're just going to see more cases and that actually because of these tensions, there's just going to have to be those arguments presented.
Yes.
I mean, presumably you have a number of clients who will say to you, Smita, please tell us what to do so that we can stay out of court because of the reputational risk, because of the kind of media circus that often surrounds these sorts of cases. I mean, what's your kind of best advice?
So my best advice is actually this is as much about being able to defend to the people you want to defend to the choices you have made, because there are some people you're never going to win round. You're never suddenly going to persuade the Daily Mail that actually you were right all along and this was a perfectly sensible thing to do, because that's not what they're looking for. What you need to be able to do is to speak to your community and communicate well with your community. The problem, of course, is that, again, there's this tension between all the laws we have around confidentiality, privacy, which say, when somebody's raised a complaint, we can't play that out in public. We can't say, this is how we investigated, this is what we found, these are the decisions we made. And the kind of desperate need of the community to understand how that issue was resolved. And that, I think, is the bigger tension. Clients, I think, find it slightly reassuring, but also slightly alarming. You know, this is not a thing you can chess game and say, in 2 years' time, I might end up in a tribunal and the tribunal will find X, because this is not the kind of landscape we're moving in. What you can do is every step of the way feel you're holding your community together as best you can. And that is proving hugely difficult at the moment over things like Israel and Gaza, other, you know, very well-recognised conflicts of position. But I think that's where we really need to focus a bit more. I think the other thing that universities would benefit from is everybody understanding that even if you complain about something and it's investigated, you might not like the outcome. So they may find that there was a problem, but it's not necessarily going to be that that person is, you know, sort of ceremonially paraded through the campus and shame sort of waved at them. That might be instinctively what we would like to see because we feel so angry about what's happened. That is not legally what is going to happen. So maybe, again, understanding that as places of learning, as places of development, we should recognise people can make mistakes and learn from them and move on, and we have to find ways to then live together after that.
I think the other thing about making these judgments, I mean, and I think that kind of point, you don't have the full information, you can't chess game it, you can't map out what the kind of outcome's going to be and say, right, this is how we're going to do it to achieve that outcome. You have to be constantly weighing up risk, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, the risk that somebody will say something, you know, because I'm talking about real material harms here as well as that kind of, you know, the risk of offence.
Yeah.
Is that if the speaker speaks and they may say something, and one of the consequences of that may be that, you know, more... If you know, say I'll try. Actually, you know what? I'll try and think of an example that's not too close to the bone. But you know, something like a speaker who comes from the sort of manosphere kind of world, and you don't know that inviting that speaker to campus will not, you know, then enable a number of you know, rise in domestic violence cases or you know, or harassment of women or whatever it is. You know, making those judgments. You know, what's the kind of, I guess, what's the balance of needing to kind of have the evidence that that would definitely happen and feeling quite concerned that that could happen and weighing that up? What does that look like?
So I think there is the presumption of the law is that speech alone should not be restricted because of the fear of consequences, except in certain very clear circumstances. So obviously, if that person is inciting others to do things, that would be where you intervene. If the idea is that the ideas floating around as a result of that speech could then lead to individuals choosing to act in a particular way, the law wouldn't necessarily see that trajectory, except in the context of prevent, of course, because that's the whole essence of prevent. You hear something and that's going to draw you into extremism. So there is even an inconsistency there. I think that what a useful legal lens to see this through is that you shouldn't be stopping the speech, but you should be understanding the impact of that on certain groups within your community. And so we go back to the much maligned, but in my view, incredibly flexible and useful public sector equality duty. And you say, okay, within this context, it might well be that women feel particularly threatened by this speaker. So what do we do to make sure that that sense of threat, that sense of I can't, you know, I don't feel as comfortable participating anymore, is addressed? And whether that's a company, you know, doing something directly with the women who feel that way or with the men who you're worried about, you can do things. And in effect, I know we're trying to steer away from controversial subjects, which is ironic given what we're talking about, but in relation to Israel and Gaza, the point I've been making to universities nonstop is actually, don't react to each individual complaint that comes up and expect that to be the solution. You've got to look at what's going on here. People are hurting. People are really worried and upset on, you know, all sides of the debate. You've got to bring your community back together. And that the lens that the law requires you to do that through is the public sector equality duty. What can you do now? So it's not an easy answer, and it rarely lends itself to banning the speech. But it makes sure that the speech doesn't just happen in a vacuum. You are thinking about the consequences and you're trying to anticipate the impact on your community as best you can.
So the reasonable standard was, it's kind of a Goldilocks concept. It was meant to help us figure out, it was meant to be that mechanism for drawing those lines, to help us separate out things too much that are too much or not enough from what is exactly just right, that safe middle ground. But also, I argue that we need to think really carefully about who gets to draw those lines. Who do the lines benefit, and who do they disenfranchise or even harm? Because that reasonable standard, when I dug into some of the scholarship that's been emerging particularly over the past 20 years, it shows that that reasonable standard was originally actually called the reasonable man standards, and by which they meant the rich, white, elite, cis, heteronormative, non-disabled Christian man. And I explore how that standard has been used to harm marginalised people in all kinds of ways, everything from victim blaming and sexual harassment trials to the racist applications of reasonable use of force. But this brings us back to free speech, because the TLDR of the book basically is that it's not that reasonableness is a bad thing, of course not. It's that we've risked confusing the appearance of reasonableness for the real thing. So here's a quote from the start of the book. Modern life works hard to convince us that watching our behaviour and tone and policing those of others is what makes us good people. Be civil, we've been told. What's needed is measured debate. Let's have yet more round tables and panel discussions. Sorry, guys. Which each side gets equal chance to air their opinion. Destroy sexist and racist ideologies by defeating them in the marketplace of ideas. Sunlight's the best disinfectant. But what if... what if all those powerful appeals to be reasonable are just a smokescreen holding us back from actually changing anything? And what if, by some people, they've actively been weaponized in that way? And I explore that question in chapters from looking at everything from civil behavior to civic protest to civil debate. But I was asked here today to give a brief socio-historical overview of free speech. So I'm going to pick up on what I say in chapter 6, which is called Whatever Happened to Public Reason. And I open that chapter by talking about how much I love talking things through, as my husband knows and is infuriated by. I'm a discourse scholar, so I love words so much that I've made studying them my entire life's work. But because of that, I also know that sometimes a plea to engage in endless talk rather than action is being deliberately weaponized to forestall progress. And I give lots of examples, one of which was the toppling of Colston's statue in 2020. I'm at the University of Bristol, so I was there when he was pulled off the pedestal, thrown in the harbor. And that's a moment where that language of lines was heard extremely loudly around the world. That line between direct action, which was often seen as unreasonable, mob rule, and democratic respect that comes from debate. Why didn't protesters just politely persuade their opponents? That's a question that lots of people were asking. And I found out when I looked into this that actually those protesters did do everything right for decades. They launched campaigns, they held protests, they made petitions, they ran radio phone-ins, and nothing changed until Colston's statue fell. And just a few weeks later, Colston Hall announced it was changing its name to Bristol Beacon, and within a year, an array of other institutions around the city followed suit, all gone. Sometimes, as the suffragette said, deeds, not words, is the only thing that we can reasonably accept in pursuit of justice. And that's not to say, obviously, that's not to say that people are inherently irrational, that they can't be reasoned with, or that debate itself is bad. It's a tool. It can be used in good ways to bring about communitarian forms of healthy, nourishing conversation. But it can also be used as a tool to stymie progress. And by and large, I worry that the societal mechanisms for public debates that we have available to us are designed more often than not to encourage dissensus. The title of that chapter comes from John Rawls's idea of public reason, that famous idea of the marketplace of ideas. But that needs to be underpinned by a genuine desire to find common ground and a shared commitment to evidence. So public reason, it's a utopian ideal, and it's a very good one. It can work, but only under certain circumstances where each side has an even amount of power and is genuinely working towards collaboration rather than division. And that's not a new idea. The ancient Greeks, they understood that there are good and bad forms of debate. They believed deeply in the right to what they call parrhesia, which is the specific kind of political rhetoric that meant speaking truth to power. But that right, before anybody was allowed to speak their mind, it was carefully regulated through mechanisms like docimasia, which was a robust character test that every 19-year-old citizen who was a man had to pass before he was allowed to speak his mind. And also, that right to parrhesia was in the moment bound by hierarchical power dynamics that required people to punch up and never down. And these kinds of accountability mechanisms were necessary for free speech to work. The ancient world understood that. How is that something that we've forgotten? And we saw that too in ancient India. So the Vadaviya was a system designed to seek understanding and reach truth. And they divided debates into three kinds: the good, the bad, and the ugly. The honest debate, Vada, where both sides are seeking truth, was the goal. But then there was a tricky debate called Jalpa, where the goal was to win with use of allowable tricks. But the really ugly one was Vitanda, where the goal was to defeat or demolish one's opponent, no matter how, even if it destroys truth and community itself. So destructive debates have always been seen as unreasonably unreasonable. On the surface, sometimes those things, civil debate, might appear calm, civilized discussions, but actually can offer legitimacy to con artists and deliberate provocateurs to reach more people with their fake news, post-truth bullshit. And that's the kind of debate that we either need very robust accountability measures to moderate, or perhaps should be shut down entirely in order to be reasonable.
I mean, no one will be surprised to hear that the academic administrator sitting on the stage thinks you need to have some really clear processes and some really clear structures and codes about how you go around working with academic free speech and external speakers. And whilst people might not like that idea of a bureaucracy, it is one of those times where it's really helpful to outline some of the rules of the game and to provide that clear audit trail that people can hang on to when things start going wrong, that can ground them when they're in the middle of a contentious issue. But all that really does is create the space in which the stuff that we're talking about now really starts to happen. I think when you start to dig into that, one of the things that you know, is really important, follows on what from Samisa was saying, was that there's a bit of prediction that institutions can do, that universities and student unions can sit down and they can probably work out where the kind of clashes are going to exist on campus, what the kind of issues are, who the different sides in those issues are going to be. And then from that, you can sort of pre-game some of the interventions that you might need to make. And that pre-planning is really important because it allows you to stay alert for when those problems manifest. It won't be foolproof. There will always be the time when somebody who seems relatively uncontentious comes to deliver an engineering lecture and turns out to have made some comments online about gender critical thinking that they might have. But that pre-planning for those kinds of issues means that you can drop that in. One of the things I talk about a lot when I talk about practicalities and systems is the importance of time and what you do with time. And I know quite often when you're working with event organisers, whether that's academic colleagues or student leaders, they get frustrated with things like, they'd say, oh, well, you must give a 3-week notice period before any event happens. But that notice period is really crucial because where you know that there's going to be students, where there's going to be colleagues who are going to be affected by an invited speaker, you use that time to engage with those people to make sure that the event can be delivered as successfully as possible. And quite often when I talk about this, people are surprised when I'm saying, if you know you've got something controversial, go to the person who's going to be most upset by them and tell them that it's going to happen. Because some people seem to think like, oh, if we don't talk about this, then they won't know. And the reality is, of course, they will know because they have this thing called the internet. And they'll find out. And then they'll be pissed off that nobody told them that it was coming. It'll damage their trust in the students' union. It'll damage their trust in the institution. They'll feel shocked. I mean, one of the things that you can do by bringing it to people's attention, saying, look, this thing's going to happen. I know that your first question is going to be, can we stop this? And under law, we can't. So let's move on from that point and let's talk about how you want to respond to this. And I expect your response is going to be angry and frustrated. And let's work through that. And then let's start to talk about how you want to engage with this or not engage with this and what you might want to do to mitigate for this or support this in a different way to support your community. That's much better than people being surprised or startled. I've never seen a good response where you shock someone with something controversial. But that seems to be some of the kind of principle that's behind some of this discussion. You'll hear some people talking about almost like, take your medicine, it's good for you to hear something that fundamentally attacks the center of your soul. You're like, I don't think that is true, but thanks. You know, helping them work through that emotional response into that practical response is really, really important. You know, for that reason, I think it's also important that institutions are talking about how they support protest. I mean, this duty gives an active duty to universities to promote free speech, not just to make sure it happens, but to promote it. And I think one of the things that universities need to get better at is saying, actually, this is how, if you want to protest, this is how we'll make that happen for you. This is how we can support you to allow that to happen in the most positive way that it can be. You know, demonstrating to activists that you want to positively support them to raise their issues and manage through it in a productive way is a crucial part of it. And that partly might be counter-protest, it might be counter-events, it might be supporting students so that they can go into certain debating chambers and meetings like this, having pre-prepped them with the ways that they're going to ask their questions so they come across in the best possible way. You know, part of that, I think, in the things that we've done in the past has been about trying to get parties to moderate or dampen their rhetoric sometimes. And, you know, I read Jim on the website earlier this week talking about how we might not do that now because that would be potentially seen as you know, a chilling effect. But it's not a chilling effect if you can demonstrate that what you're trying to do is actively get people to engage in the conversation in a productive way and in a way that makes their points, gets them to make their points, without them falling into the trap of inappropriate behaviour or allegations of inappropriate behaviour that then mean that that individual spends the next 6 months wrapped up in a disciplinary or investigatory process, probably involving them making a counter-allegation against the person who made the allegation in the first place. And just this kind of non-productive zapping of everybody's energy, you know, all parts of the debate, but also the institutions, you're trying to work your way through to something that quite often doesn't have a very clear outcome, doesn't have a you were definitely right and you were definitely wrong, but is somewhere in between. I mean, for me, that's a point of pragmatism. You know, making a point aggressively in the moment might make you feel great, but the consequences of that that come with it won't make you feel great in any way. I think as part of that as well, there's an importance in everybody recognising that on certain conflicts on campus, there is no happy medium. There's no middle ground that you're going to reach. There's no consensus point that you're going to get to. And I always talk about the best that you can do is to try and aim for putting people into the zone of minimum distress. It's like, you are going to be upset by this, and I can't remove all of that upset. But what I can do by guiding you through this conversation, by you know, helping you build these alternative mitigating things around this, is that I can reduce that distress to a minimum level. And I'll still recognize that some of that distress might be a lot of distress, because it's never going to be less than a lot of distress, because the person who stood in front of you or that you're having to listen to is basically attacking your identity and saying that you shouldn't exist or you don't have the right to believe what you believe.
Now, finally this week, a BBC documentary has been asking whether university is good value for money. And David, it's been riling up all sorts of people.
It certainly has, Jim. Yeah, so Jeff Norcott has produced this documentary with the BBC looking at this question of, is university really worth the money? And is asking it from his own personal...
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Perspective with a comical perspective on whether he should save money for his son to go to university or whether he should spend that money on a new car. It is quite a wide documentary in terms of the number of topics that he's covering within this. Within this short little documentary, he's covering things around industrial action, how cost of living crisis is affecting students, the pandemic, VC pay, grade inflation, changing student needs. It's very broad, and by the nature of that, actually doesn't manage to go into too much detail on where the potential solutions for some of these challenges are that the sector has been grappling with. It also misses out on quite a lot from my perspective. It doesn't talk much about widening participation and the ways in which higher education in its massification over the last few decades has reached out to a wider breadth of society than it did before. It doesn't talk much about student choice and the idea that perhaps it should be his son who decides whether he wants to go to university, or the fact that massification of higher education means that for more students, they have that choice than they would have before. It talks about tuition fees increasing, but not about government funding to higher education changing around 2010 when that happened. And it doesn't also talk much about how students actually pay for higher education, kind of this idea that perhaps we within the sector know isn't the case, but that you have to put aside a pot of money for your children to be able to go to university. Whereas, in fact, we know that for most students, at least domestic students, there is a loan system that only affects them after they graduate. It's obviously not made for folks like us within the sector, so I'm cautious that we don't try and respond directly like we could pretend to be impartial in our views. But I did think that there were some really interesting nuggets within it. There was a short section where Jeff interviewed an estranged student talking about the cost of living crisis and how it affected her, how she was spending £20 over 2 weeks just for her groceries, and the ways in which she didn't get support elsewhere for her studies. That, for me, would have been a thing to explore in more detail. Unfortunately, in the breadth of this documentary, it was just about 1 minute, and then that was done with. Yeah.
So I came into this with a sort of a hunch, really, and I'm coming out of it with a fairly straightforward opinion too. The university has become way too much of a business, but every business should actually focus on who's the client in this situation, right? It's the student, isn't it? And it's just not working for them. It's evidently not working. You've got a situation where the cost of something has gone up dramatically, but it does seem like the value of it has gone down.
I mean, Becky, in many ways, I thought it was like a kind of Now album of Telegraph front pages on universities, right? I mean, it was all the sort of classic, moaning about universities narratives. But one thing that I thought was extraordinary was he didn't really talk about the government at all, did he?
No, and it was very bleak. Monday night viewing, thank you for directing me towards that. It didn't. And it didn't really talk about society or the pandemic or, the consequences of that on universities and students' experiences were there in that documentary. And were interesting. It was interestingly put together. And I think we recognise all of those things in the experience of our students and staff. But I think there was a huge amount of absence there, and the absence was that wider context, but also all of the kind of social mobility experience outside those factors that were there, the kind of protective space that university can provide for people to explore, to be creative, to learn new skills, were really absent. So it really missed a lot, and I think that was a shame, really, yeah. really to do that. And I suppose I wondered afterwards whether there was more we could do as institutions to articulate that, actually. How do we get that out there? How do we counter some of those arguments?
Mark, I thought one of the things that was kind of interesting was actually there isn't a lot of telly about universities, right? I mean, one of the things that has kind of taken the sector by surprise over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years is suddenly getting lots of press coverage. And we know from our conversations with the press that they will say, well, there's lots of clicks in it. But actually, there's not a lot of telly on universities. And when there is, it's often, you know, dramas about the upper echelons of the Russell Group. And actually, if nothing else, at least we got, you know, a kind of broad perspective on a number of student issues that are being talked about, even if we might not like how they were talked about.
Yeah, that's right. I think, I mean, we're not the audience for that documentary. And on The Wonky Show, we're going to be, you know, very easily taken apart on a kind of wonky level. it doesn't, you know, a lot of it doesn't stack up. I guess the most dispiriting bit, though, for me was about, you know, really this framing of, well, it's higher education or apprenticeships, which the government's been pushing for a long time, but again, doesn't really stack up. You know, the alternatives aren't fully there and doesn't recognise student choice, all sorts of, doesn't recognise the levels of skills provision inside higher education, all sorts of things it doesn't recognise. That said, it's important that we watch it and engage with it, which is why we're talking about it today, because more people will see that documentary than they will sadly listen to The Wonky Show, I'm afraid. and these sorts of things have a habit of, you know, latching on to popular imagination about what happens inside universities. And as you say, you know, we've not been brilliantly served in recent times as a sector in the kind of popular culture. We've talked at this event about some of the old tropes about students. Those are, you know, all over the place, writ large. You can think of some fantastic series, you know, like Fresh Meat or things like that, have been really good, but they do nothing to kind of really get under the skin of what happens at university or the, you know, the real concerns of students. So there is a good film of some kind to be made about what is happening in the modern state of higher education. This definitely wasn't it, and we've not seen it elsewhere either. I think the other thing you're hinting at there is Saltburn, obviously, another thing in the kind of popular culture that got everyone talking about universities and behaviour at university in the last few months, which was an interesting moment, although again doesn't really give us much to latch onto as policy wonks.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Becky, David, Mark, Debbie, Kirsty, Smita, Andy, our fantastic live audience here at Secret Life of Students, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.